Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes back Ned Sublett to discuss his book, The Year Before the Flood, A Story of New Orleans, and lots of NOLA R&B, funk, and hip-hop. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today, Ned Sublett is returning to discuss his book, The Year Before the Flood, A Story of New Orleans. Ned, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Cool. And so this is the second book about New Orleans that you wrote. As a pair, we discussed the first book, The World That Made New Orleans.
The World That Made New Orleans, yes.
A little while ago. Tell us about The Year Before the Flood and why it's so narratively different, because The World That Made New Orleans is a pretty straight-up history book, but you're very much part of the narrative of the second book.
The original idea was that The World That Made New Orleans and The Year Before the Flood would be one big book. And of course, it didn't have those titles yet. My editor talked me out of that idea, as it was both impractical from my publishing standpoint and also didn't really make a lot of sense narratively, since my point of view changed so drastically as I got into the present day. And it was going to be kind of a two-part history of New Orleans, but also I was very much feeling the need to write something of a memoir, less a memoir of me as of what I saw, that is to say, a memoir of the world as I perceived it from my personal perspective. And we published The World That Made New Orleans first, and it turned out to be a big hit. We really thought that The Year Before the Flood would be the hit, but it wasn't. The World That Made New Orleans, however, was and continues to be quite popular. And I still get, I see from the royalty statement, so far The World That Made New Orleans has sold more than my other three books combined. And, you know, I'm just delighted to have a book that does that. However, The Year Before the Flood, in many ways, is my favorite book. It's a book that's in my voice, and I do continue in it the history that The World That Made New Orleans leaves off in the early 19th century. We go as far as the beginning of Congo Square in The World That Made New Orleans, but we continue on in this book through the the war of Southern Rebellion. After that, the 1880s, which were a very important era in New Orleans, and into the 20th century in the Civil Rights Movement and my own lifetime. So a history told in flashback.
And it's a very powerful book and a very powerful technique. And I think this book might be more than some people can handle. Like, the other New Orleans book is a textbook that talks about sort of relatively ancient history in a relatively straightforward way. And while the history can be upsetting because of slavery and Native American genocide, it's at arm's length. But in this book, you're right in the story. And I don't want to spoil it, but I do really want to urge people to read this book. The personal narrative is very powerful and compelling, and there's this great surprise, not quite ending, but climax that's really powerful. I don't I don't want to give it away.
I actually want to jump in there because I don't think the world of New Orleans isn't a textbook. It really isn't. It's designed to be a book you can read on the plane. It's designed to be a book for the general reader, and it's not really ancient history. It's one of the points of the world that made New Orleans is that slavery wasn't that long ago. We think of it as a very, very long time in the United States. Well, we can't at this point remember what happened yesterday if it doesn't refresh on the screen. But slavery wasn't really all that long ago in historical terms, and its consequences are with us everywhere, and you definitely see them in New Orleans today.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're really in your face in the year before the flood.
They're really in your face.
and so, yeah, I wasn't trying to disparage the other book at all because it's a wonderful book and a fun read and not some heavy tome. But the year before the flood just crawls out of the pages and grabs you and is scary and heartbreaking. And the cruelty and racism hasn't even taken a lunch break, basically. It's
that's right.
It's ever present. And, so I think that might have been a little harder for people to handle. But there's a line in there, because you start the book with your childhood in Louisiana, in Natchitoches, which is in Northeast Louisiana. Talk about your musical awakening and also your cultural awakening and kind of how you began to figure out some of these complicated consequences of slavery in our American history of racism. But you had a line in there where early on you're talking quite a bit about movies and your interest in movies as a child, but you kind of segue more to music and you say it's because movies told me lies, but music told me the truth. Can you elaborate on that distinction?
Right. That's right. Music told me a kind of truth that I didn't otherwise have access to. And I, as a child, lived in a world of images. It was we kind of had a metaverse back then. If you spent your entire life at the movie theater and listening to pop music, you were in faraway places all the time. Also, if you read books, I might add. And music, music was the only place I could hear black voices, because I lived in Natchitoches, Louisiana, northwestern Louisiana, a town of about 10,000, about half black. And I lived there until I was 9. We moved away in 1960. And I was never in a single social space together with a black child. We were kept completely apart, whether it was at the bathrooms, at the gas station, buying a Dr. Pepper, at the movie theater, much less going into the library, which black people couldn't go into, or at school, which was segregated. So the one space where I heard black voices was on the radio. And I heard a kind of truth. Now, music can lie, but I heard a kind of truth coming out of those voices. And meanwhile, the movies that I saw, raised on movies, just gave me a diet, a steady diet of lies. Lies about what life was like, lies about what our history was. The first great movie spectacle, The Birth of the Nation, by now completely discredited as racist trash that sparked a new iteration of the Ku Klux Klan, a despicable film by any reckoning. But at that time, The Birth of a Nation was still being lauded as the greatest movie ever made, and indeed it was the birth of the feature film and the spectacle. And from then on, we saw all kinds of movies with agendas of one kind or another, made by white people for white people. We saw, I mean, it was the 50s when I was a child, was the great era of the Westerns. We saw these Westerns over and over. We saw movies set in faraway cities that didn't really, that told, there was one thing that movies did well, I think, which was explore space. And I got my sense, I think one of the, to give my grand vision of movies, I would say that I learned the beauty of the North American continent by watching movies. And that in the Westerns, you would see these great spaces unfold, that some of which later I got to know personally. But the stories we were told were mostly just racist trash. And to this day, honestly, I don't like fiction films. I can't sit through a movie. I lived in, I'm angrier because I bought them all. I lived in the movies when I was a child, and I'm still unlearning what they taught me. That's why I study history, and I'm still trying to understand the truth, which is why I keep listening to music.
And let's hear our first tune. This is King Oliver with Louis Armstrong. This is one of the first instances of Black New Orleanians recording jazz on record. This is Dipper Mouth Blues. And that was a very young Louis Armstrong and his mentor, King Oliver, doing Dipper Mouth Blues, I think, in 1923. And now I'm going to kind of twist your arm and try to make you talk about the music you talk about in the book in a chronological narrative fashion. So apologies for that. But I want to cover the history. And you bring out some angles that I had never heard before. You don't spend a ton of time on the creation of jazz, which pretty much indisputably was birthed in New Orleans in the 1890s, 1900s. But you talk about some stuff that happens in the 1880s. And one of the key things that happened was the 8th Regiment Cavalry Band from Mexico came to New Orleans.
Yes.
And brought a lot of music with them. Tell us about that.
Directed by Encarnacion Payen. Yes, it was the big success of the Cotton Expo, which served notice to the world, a giant international trade fair that served to the notice to the world that New Orleans was back. And there were all kinds of things going on at this expo, the Buffalo Bills Wild West show with Annie Oakley came to town and camped out on the grounds that later became Tulane University. But the big hit was the Mexican band, which played a varied program and which brought a number of people who Mexican musicians who remained in New Orleans and became teachers of that first generation of jazz musicians. Not all of them, obviously, but those who took lessons from Lorenzo Tio, for example, became important musicians in the early days of jazz.
Yeah, and this to me was a really key missing piece because, you know, they talk about jazz as this sort of amalgamation of ragtime and blues by marching bands. And, you know, when I went back and listened to John Philip Sousa, I was like, you know, this is cool, but I'm not hearing what Buddy Bolden must have heard here to inspire him. And this Mexican marching band playing this heavily Cuban-influenced music, that to me connects the dots.
I mean, there are things you can point to in Sousa if you want to. I mean, Sousa was a racist asshole, I should note. If you've read his autobiography, you know that. He certainly knew how to score for a marching band and get a thrilling sound. Everybody, I actually play the Stars and Stripes Forever sometimes on the rare occasions when I teach. And almost everybody knows the piccolo obbligato in the Stars and Stripes Forever, right? You know, that piccolo solo that goes all the way through it. That, think of that in terms of the jazz solo to be. This is where it was a written out obbligato, but you were starting to hear musicians play these improvised obbligatos around the main melody, filling in, you know, in the second half of the phrase, etc. Over time, as Thomas Brothers discusses in his wonderful book, Louis Armstrong's New Orleans, this obbligato starts to become more and more central and ultimately become the improvised solo. So we actually can connect Sousa to early jazz, but there's a lot more going on. And of course, one of the interesting things about early jazz is we don't know what it sounded like because it happened outside the earshot of history. We don't have any recordings of Buddy Bolden. We have a lot of accounts of what he sounded like. We have Louis Armstrong's own account of hearing Buddy Bolden, which would have had to have been when he was at the most 5 years old or perhaps four, but apparently a vivid enough memory that he remembered it.
Yeah, that's the fascinating thing about Buddy Bolden. I mean, we don't have like an figure for the blues. We kind of do for ragtime with Scott Joplin, arguably. But with jazz, there seems to be a consensus that we know who the cool Herc was. It was Buddy Bolden playing blues on his cornet, really loud, doing this crazy song called Funky Butt that stirred people up. But Buddy's not recorded that we know of. He might have cut some cylinders that we haven't tracked down. But
we haven't seen him.
Anybody who knows the story knows that Buddy goes mad around 1907 or 1908 and never recovers and spends the last decade and a half of his life in a mental institution. And you have a theory on what triggered Buddy Bolden's psychosis that totally blew my mind. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and it is. I hasten to label it as a theory because, of course, there's no way to prove it. But it's Bolden. Let me just see if I can find it here in the book itself. Bolden's madness, coming on at the height of his powers in 1906, has never been satisfactorily explained. Some have linked it with his heavy drinking. Jelly Roll Morton and other contemporaries of his suggested that he blew his brains out playing too loud. Actually, it was Armstrong who suggested that as well. Latter-day commentators have linked his dementia to the pressure of racism or suggested he wasn't really mad at all. But there's another possibility to consider that Buddy Bolden was right. His family was administering a deadly drug to him. This hypothesis has not, to my knowledge, previously come up in discussions of Bolden. I'd like to assemble some circumstantial evidence for it, presuming that it can never be proved or disproved. Here's how Don Marquis describes what happened to Bolden. Quote, he began having severe headaches in March 1906. His wife, Nora, mentioned these bad spells and said he seemed to be afraid of his cornet. Her sister Dora recalled that Buddy's playing began to cause him anguish, seemed to tear him up, and his headaches gave him so much pain he would play wrong notes. She used to go to Adam's drugstore on Howard Street to get medicine for him when he was suffering. End quote. What medicine was Dora getting him at Adam's drugstore? If it was a headache remedy, it was quite possibly cocaine. 3 months after Bolden's flip-out on June 30th, 1906, President Theodore Roosevelt signed the landmark Pure Food and Drug Act, which required for the first time disclosure of ingredients in drugstore remedies. Upton Sinclair's novel The Jungle, an expose of filthy conditions in meatpacking plants, is usually cited as having provided the public outrage that pushed the bill through. But that was the food side. The drug side of the law was propelled both by popular outcry and by growing concern in the medical profession about the excessive unlabeled use of cocaine in a wide range of over-the-counter patent medicines, tonics, and other products. And it goes on from there. But my suggestion is that Bolden was suffering from cocaine psychosis, quite possibly without even knowing it. If his sister went to get Rhino's headache powder, it was 90% pharmaceutical cocaine.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of cocaine. It seems like every few generations, we have to relearn cocaine is bad, kids.
Yeah, well, I mean, it never went away in New Orleans. One thing about New Orleans, things, you know, I feel like one of my big points in the year before the flood, if I may, actually was a perception I had studying ancient Egypt. Ancient Egypt's actually pretty good object of study if you want to understand New Orleans. the book by Jan Assmann, Assmann, proposed, this word gets used different ways, but chronotopes. A chronotope is a time place, right? How time passes in a given place. There's this kind of cliche that, oh, time passes differently here, and you think, well, that's just romanticism. But actually, time, as the locals understand it, is somewhat different in New Orleans. And there are, more broadly speaking, two ideas of time. There's what you might call circle time, or recursive time, or cyclical time, and arrow time, or progressive time. What do I mean by that? In progressive time, there's a progress. Things move from one event forward to a development in the future, as in the Christian idea of the birth of Jesus and his second coming at a millennium. So the years are numbered zero forward. Every year has a higher number. In cycle time, every year is the same as the last. And in Egypt, as far as I know, the actual years were not numbered, though the dynasties were. And in order for this to work, you have to nail it down with festivals and a calendar that of recurring events. You have to you read ancient history and you see over and over, you know, going to war being postponed until they could have the festival of such and such a god, without which nothing would go right. So New Orleans is nothing if not a town of a very complex calendar of festivals. And in New Orleans, something happens. Other places, you know, something happens and it's over and the next thing happens. In New Orleans, something happens and it continues to happen. So, you know, young men still learn the sousaphone so that they might have a better life. Finally, they stopped having people smoke in bars. But when I lived there in 2004, 2005, people still smoked in bars. They still eat a diet that seems to be from another century, et cetera. You know, 50s R&B is still the shit. Hurricane Audrey is still going on, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a sense of the...
of 50s R&B, and this is also brings in questions of time and the festivals. This is the Hawkettes with the young Aaron Neville singing lead. This is the Mardi Gras Mambo.
Down in New Orleans where the blues were born, it takes a cool cat to blow a horn. On the side and Rampart Street, the combos play with the mambo beat. The Mardi Gras Mambo, Mambo, Mambo. Mardi Gras Mambo, 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 Mardi Gras Mambo, down in New Orleans. In good time where the cats all meet, it's the Mardi Gras Mambo with the beat.
And that was the Hawkettes doing a Mardi Gras Mambo with Aaron Neville on lead vocals.
Originally a country record. Art Neville on the vocals.
My bad, Art Neville. And I always get my brothers confused. And that sort of segues us to the next big musical explosion that comes out of New Orleans, which is in the 40s and 50s. There's a studio. Cosimo Matassa has a studio. A guy named Dave Bartholomew starts putting bands together. He meets a young pianist named Fats Domino, who becomes his frontman. The two of them have a successful musical partnership. But they make a lot more records than just Fats Domino records, or even than just Dave Bartholomew records. basically, I mean, everybody's recording with them. Little Richard is recording with this band. The great Earl Palmer, who's the drummer that essentially invents rock and roll drumming, plays for them and plays with Little Richard through that. Tell us about this second wave of New Orleans creativity that explodes in rhythm and blues and rock and roll in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah. Dave Bartholomew created the first studio band in U.S. music history. The band that the singer could come into, and there was a band there. There was one studio, and when that studio went out of business in the 60s, not for lack of business, but because of too much success, which caused a series of debts that they couldn't service. When that studio went out of business, it was very bad because it was still the only recording studio in New Orleans all these years. Cosimo Matassa's studio, and Cosimo had a way of working that everybody understood. Everybody was there in one room together. They would play a song as many times as necessary to make it happen. 15 takes of a song was not unheard of if Cosimo felt they hadn't quite gotten there yet. Dave Bartholomew was the genius who led that band. And if you listen to The Fat Man, Fats Domino's first hit from 1949 with Earl Palmer on drums, when that the shuffle feeling becomes more literalized and it's a much simpler rhythm nailed down with a backbeat, that's the beginning, you might say, of rock and roll drumming. If there's one guy who none of these things were done by one person, but if there is one guy who we could say invented rock and roll drumming, Earl Palmer would have the best claim on that, having done it not just with the Fat Man, but with various records on which he invented various approaches that later became standard. And yeah, this fame of Cosimo Matassa's studio out of New Orleans as a center of recording and also live gigging was such that all sorts of people came to New Orleans to get their early hits. So you had Ray Charles record in New Orleans. You had Sam Cooke record in New Orleans before he was a big solo star. You had Guitar Slim, you know, the things I used to do. You had, and famously, Little Richard, for which Palmer first invented what some drummers call the half and half groove, which is to say shuffling while straight eighths are going on, and then finally playing that straight eighths backbeat on Lucille. I might note that Palmer then moved on to Los Angeles, where he became a superstar session drummer, and with Ritchie Valens invented two more of the fundamental beats, La Bamba, which was a rocked up cha-cha-cha, and the Come On, Let's Go beat, which was still being played well into the 90s.
And I should mention that jazz kind of fell apart in New Orleans when the Surgeon General of the U.S. shut down Storyville, the Vice District. There was no place for musicians to work. People like Louis Armstrong and King Oliver migrate to Chicago, later on to New York. Some of them went all the way to San Francisco. And, you know, there's this great jazz diaspora out of New Orleans, and it kind of conquers the planet from other places. And the second wave of African-American musical invention in the 20th century in New Orleans stays together in New Orleans better. But like you say, Earl Palmer leaves for LA in the late 50s, union disputes. He just got much better pay. He was treated fairly in LA. And in New Orleans, there was a segregated musicians union that screwed over the black musicians. But nonetheless, Dave Bartholomew and Fats Domino, you know, have their 50-year run. Cosimo keeps his studio going into the mid-60s. A guy named Alain Toussaint comes along, kind of picks up the torch in the late 50s, producing records like Ernie Cato's Mother-in-Law, and then leads a process that helps invent funk with people like Lee Dorsey, and puts together a new studio band that becomes known as the Meters later on. Tell us, why is New Orleans considered holy ground for funk? And why do people like George Clinton consider it, you know, kind of the motherland of funk?
funny you mentioned George. The one time I got to interview him, it was a very short interview. It was I chased him around all weekend trying to get the interview. This was back in the 90s. And his publicist said, okay, show up at the hotel when they arrive. So I was there. They get off the bus, totally road burn. I feel totally stupid. Hello, Mr. Clinton, I'd like to interview you. Yeah, okay, come to the show. Talk to me after the show. So I come to the show. Tramps 4-hour show, like it's 4 a.m. and I get my interview for Afropop Worldwide. So I go down and he clearly does not want to do an interview at this moment after 4 hours of screaming on stage. Yeah. But he does it for 3 minutes. But every single thing he said was perfect and perfectly usable. It was actually quite a worthwhile interview. And unbidden, I asked him, I was still new at the interviewing game, and I asked him a really dumb question in retrospect. What's the about the George Clinton definition of funk? And he got to talking unprompted by me about the importance of New Orleans and the Meters. I was really impressed by that. And the answer is, of course, that in New Orleans, genre walls aren't at all rigid. It's one big, I'm tempted to even use the dreaded gumbo metaphor, but it's one big stew of music that whatever you play, whatever genre you're ostensibly playing, it's going to sound like you're in New Orleans. And the lingua franca way of playing music in New Orleans is what becomes funk. What is funk? Indeed, George Clinton's definition was funk is good toilet paper. I asked Bobby Byrd, James Brown's musical director, about what musically is funk, and he said rhythmic independence. When everybody playing a different rhythm and it's all fitting together like a glove. This gets going in New Orleans somehow, this way of playing, so that funk becomes the lingua franca of New Orleans music. And there's reason to think that Earl Palmer was the guy who got people talking about playing it funky. Funk, of course, is a word that meant bad smell forever, going back to the 17th century. You can find it in the modern sense in the Oxford English Dictionary is from Virginia in the 17th century. So this word for a bad smell, as in funky butt, becomes an attitude toward playing music. And to this day, to my mind, if you want to understand funk, if you want to understand jazz, go to New Orleans, because the musics that we call by those names. And of course, there is a movement now to stop using the word jazz. And a lot of people, for a lot of people, New Orleans history only begins with jazz. For a lot of people, New Orleans is jazz and that's it. But there's so much more that comes out of the New Orleans variety of musical approaches than funk, R&B, and jazz even. There is, for example, Mardi Gras Indian music, which predates jazz.
And hear from our sponsors. When we come back, you can tell us about Mardi Gras Indian music.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycom order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
So let's talk about the Mardi Gras Indians. You mentioned Big Bill, Wild Bill's Western show in the 1880s, Buffalo Bill Cody, mass murder of the native buffalo, had this Wild West show in the 1880s. Some people think that was the inspiration for the Mardi Gras Indian, which is when African-American men costume themselves in Native American regalia and parade in the streets. This has got its own parallel history with, like, with everything in New Orleans. There's a white Mardi Gras and there's a black Mardi Gras. Tell us about the black Mardi Gras.
Okay, well, I've been doing Zooms twice a month, which anybody can join, by the way. Email me, postmambo@gmail.com, if you want to get on one of my Zooms. I had an interview with Dr. Maurice Martinez, who's now 88 and who made the first film about Mardi Gras Indians in 1976. And he went on an extended diatribe against the idea that Buffalo Bill's Wild West show was the inspiration for the Mardi Gras Indians. Now, I tell the story in the book, and of course, I'm one of those people who looks for consensus, and I sort of think that everybody's right in this sense. That is to say, the Creole Wild West, which is the first organized Mardi Gras Indian gang, or now we say black masking Indians, the first Mardi Gras Indian gang that we know of, they call them gangs, in the 1880s, happens the year at the first Mardi Gras of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show in New Orleans. The parallelism is very, very great. And there are other reasons to note the influence. Buffalo Bill's Wild West show made a huge impression on New Orleans. They had to draw people to a spectacle of pageantry like that. Joe Roach writes about this in Cities of the Dead. They would have these giant parades and processions through town, and the stars of this procession were fully dressed Plains Indians who were being allowed to display their culture in public at a time when African Americans were utterly ghettoized and weren't allowed to display theirs. So the way I see it is that this became something that could be borrowed, appropriated, even satirized, if you will, to make the Creole Wild West. But what the Mardi Gras Indians are about and represent is way older than the Buffalo Bill Wild West show and does not really take its inspiration from that. It's almost all of the narratives that I've heard take it back to Congo Square, which was a kind of a both a place of preservation, but also a laboratory where a new African-American music, a new Orleans music was formed in the early 19th century. The roots of Mardi Gras Indianing go way back before the 1880s, in other words. And it becomes what its practitioners want it to be, by which I mean that it's similar. We can find things that remind us of other things that happen in the Antilles. We can, some people are struck by certain parallels to the Abaqua cult of Cuba. Some people are struck by resemblances to things that happen at Carnival in Trinidad or Brazil. We can see some similarities, but it's peculiarly, idiomatically, and originally New Orleans. And the meaning of Mardi Gras Indians has changed greatly over the years. A lot of Black public celebrations in New Orleans, I think, changed with the civil rights movement, of which New Orleans was a central nucleus, a very important spot of a very important part of the civil rights movement was New Orleans. All of this moved the meaning of Mardi Gras Indians into a new era. Famously, of course, Tootie Montana, who proposed a shifting in the culture from actual physical fighting to aesthetic competition. But my point in bringing them up was the music. Mardi Gras Indians have a very interesting and original musical repertoire, which in some way, though we don't have recordings, predates jazz. And, or as my wife said after we saw Bo Dallas's 30-year anniversary in show business concert at the House of Blues in 2005, without the Mardi Gras Indians, all the rest of it would crumble. The Mardi Gras Indians, for those who don't know, are small groups of African-American men who go out at on Mardi Gras Day and also on a couple of other times a year, St. Joseph's Night and Super Sunday, and some come out during Jazz Fest as well, and others perform during the year, but they're all musically in their suits. But it's really Mardi Gras and St. Joseph's Night and Super Sunday are the three big moments for displaying their work. They make these elaborate suits, which probably everybody's seen pictures of now, which have to be made from scratch every year, which cost a tremendous amount of money. The people who do it are mostly from historically from the artisan class. That is to say, they have physical skills. Tootie Montana was a lathe operator and could make these tremendous three-dimensional suits. Their music, because it is so, goes back so far, can become any other kind of genre of New Orleans music if you put those clothes on it. That is to say, Iko Iko, a song we've probably all heard, was a pop hit record by the Dixie Cups. Its first recording by Sugar Boy Crawford as Giacomo was more a kind of R&B mambo. Dr. John gave it the funk treatment. Henry Butler played it as jazz. You can really do this music any of a number of ways. And the repertoire of songs isn't huge, but keep hearing more songs all the time. The longer the tradition develops, it's a creative tradition. People continue to add to it. The latest new treatment that I've heard is from a group called Seven Niners Gang. A chief from the 7th Ward and a chief from the 9th Ward, Romeo Bourget and Germaine Bossière, who get to get together and have a more hip-hop flavored version of Mardi Gras Indian music. Also with, when I saw them recently, live timbales along with a drum set, which gave it a really solid sound that I just love. I want to say one more thing about that, which is that it is, for the people who do it, it is a major lifetime commitment, both in civic terms, because Mardi Gras Indians are, to be a Mardi Gras Indian today is about being a good citizen, and both in civic terms and also in terms of the aesthetics of it. You are committed to do that. This is a way of life for you that that occasions a spiritual transformation. I've talked to several chiefs about what happens when they put on that suit, and they talk about going into a spiritual transformation, even akin to a kind of spirit possession that you might see at religious events.
Before I play our next tune, I want to bring up, there's one genre of music that is a little bit separate. You talk about how, you know, there's a great record store that was there in New Orleans when you were there that would play all kinds of New Orleans music except for this one genre, and that's hip hop, of course, to which New Orleans has made massive contributions. And this is Manny Fresh's Real Big, the clean version. And before you talk about the divide between hip hop and all the other music of New Orleans, I want you to also tell us your riff on why the clean version, why you should get your hip hop at Walmart, basically, why the clean is better than the explicit. This is Manny Fresh, Real Big.
I'm a real big time king of the hood. Everything wood. Look like a forest in the truck and I'm a pull. Maxis overset, big open deck. Hardwood flows and that thing that connect from the front to the back. Try to top that. 6'15", beating hard in the deck. Push that button, microwave oven. I'm just getting started, pimp. You ain't seen nothing. That a fish tank, bro.
Okay, that was Manny Fresh's Real Big, the clean version. Now you can tell us why you should get your hip-hop at home.
Manny Fresh and Real Big. Let's back up. I always, as you know, I always zoom out first. New Orleans was one of the last places to get hip-hop going, really. When I was there in 1992, I went around to the record stores trying to find hip hop records, and there wasn't much, weren't that, I mean, the local labels were very small. There were still, I bought a single by a 12 inch by Mia X, who's still around. She's now a senior figure who promotes, healthy cooking. In the 90s, two labels got going, as many people know, Master P's No Limit and the Williams Brothers Cash Money Records, and each of which had its own sound and its own house production team. They made the records cheaply and sold them massively. And these records, especially after both Biggie and Tupac were taken out, Master P's No Limit sort of filled the void for a gritty product at that hole that had kind of opened up in the market at that moment. And Cash Money, with Manny Fresh producing all the tracks, and whose first big group was the Hot Boys, which later which included Juvenile, Lil Wayne, Beachy, and Turk, three of whom had platinum records on their own subsequently. And Lil Wayne, of course, going into a whole other level of megastardom in the 21st century. And my contention is that the Cash Money records, Manny Fresh's records, will stand. You know, 50 years from now, we'll be able to put them on, and boy, these sound great, even as the passions of that time have cooled and the rawness and raunchiness fades into history the way the rawness and raunchiness of earlier times seems somewhat more acceptable now than it did when it was coming out. When I say buy your hip hop at Walmart, of course, Walmart insisted on selling only sanitized versions. And of course, radio would only play sanitized versions. So all the curse words, as well as the N word and the B word, had to be beeped out. Now, I have a theory, which is that, I'm somebody who believes that the greatest rapper was Rakim. And one of the things that was so great about Rakim was his vocabulary. He had a whole cosmology, and he had a vocabulary that was particularly evocative because he did not curse. Every time, I curse a lot in my own songs too. So, I sympathize with people who like to curse in their lyrics. But, every time you curse, there's a better word you could have used. And if you listen to the clean versions, often you'll get like just a blank where that curse word was. And that to me somehow opens up more space in it, makes it more open, as well as being just plain old less gross. The Manny Fresh record that you played, you played the clean version, right? Cars, yep. Real big, belly real, belly big, real big, rings real big, cars real big, rings real big, belly real big. Let me tell you how I live. I think it was, belly real big in the dirty version was dick real big, which is if you bought the album, what you got. And somehow I was like, I was less enthusiastic about that one, but belly real big was funny.
Yeah.
There are lots of examples. There are a lot of, hip hop records where many of the words in the track are dipped out, and you get this very interesting rhythmic texture of words and silences, which are also built into the song from the outset because the rappers know this is going to happen. And the curse words kind of become accent points, which can either become a curse word or a silence.
Tell us a little bit about bounce, which was the subgenre of hip hop that predated both No Limit and Cash Money Records. This is a really unique thing to New Orleans, but it starts with the record from New York, the Drag Rap by the Showboys. How did one record that wasn't a hit nationally come from New York and become a whole genre in New Orleans?
And this is something that started to happen in a couple of places around this time where a single record, there were actually, I probably exaggerated a little bit in my book, there were other tracks that were part of early bounce. It wasn't only Drag Rap, but the Drag Rap, or as they called it in New Orleans, the Trigger Man beat, was so pervasive. So many of the early bounce hits were made to the Trigger Man beat. And it's a little hard to say what it was about that. Now I can point to things about it, but there's no real answer as to why this caught on. Often there never is a real answer as to why things catch on, but the fact is they do. You think of this one rhythm, the dembow rhythm that becomes reggaeton, this one dance hall reggae beat that spawns an entire genre, Miami bass music. did something rather similar in the 90s. But in New Orleans, it was Showboys Drag Rap, which was on Profile Records and was apparently brought to New Orleans by Run DMC on tour. Run DMC were Profile artists. And apparently, they brought the record with them. And for whatever reason, it became a hit. The Trigger Man was the first record that people heard that that used that beat, and that beat had a used the 808 drum machine, and was built on the had the Dragnet theme in the Showboys record, bum bum bum, which is kind of becomes an object, a musical object denoting crime. You know, bum, 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 that just almost suggests that suggests police procedure, criminal investigation, et cetera. In other words, the appropriate vibe for gangster rap. But I also note that although it's not the rhythmic basis, that is the habanera rhythm, which we hear so much in New Orleans. Boom, boom, boom. Boom, boom, boom. I don't know, but I do know that the bounce grows out of this genre, and still today in New Orleans, we talk about bounce. Bounce became a permanent part of the New Orleans scene. I mentioned before that in New Orleans, something happens, it continues to happen. Bounce has continued to happen. We hear today, you know, after Katrina, after the big change, by that time, most of the big gangster rappers were living outside. You know, the Cash Money guys, many of them had moved to Florida, which has no state income tax. And there was a kind of a hole in New Orleans hip hop that allowed for the so-called sissy bounce to emerge. Big Frida, Sissy Novi, etc. And this was, they called it sissy bounce. It was still bounce. And bounce continues to be the sound. It's by now, it's of course, it's not all the Trigger Man beat. It's various kinds of beats that come together under that umbrella, but there's still some kind of sensibility cluster there that we can identify as bounce.
And let's hear our final song snippet. And this is another example of how things never end in New Orleans. And this is Dr. John toward the end of his career with Mavis Staples doing a very different on When the Saints Go Marching In. This is something I would never have heard had not been for your recommendation.
That glory number, oh yes I do.
And that was the late, great Dr. John with the late, great Mavis Staples doing When the Saints Go Marching In.
Mavis is still with us.
My bad.
No. We can't have that dirge yet.
My apologies.
Mavis, we love you. Please,
yes, don't leave us, Mavis. We need you. Need you more than ever. But this is a classic example. This is a really powerful version of When the Saints Go Marching In, which has to be the corniest song, you know, to come out of the New Orleans jazz explosion. I mean, it's been so drained of interest by bad trad jazz bands all around the world butchering it. I butchered it for many years playing my recorder as a kid, but to hear it with such power in the 21st century from somebody like Dr. John, who to me, you know, his heyday was 1968 or the early 70s or when he was working with Doc Pomus in the 80s. But, you know, as you point out, many of these New Orleans artists were still making great work right up to the end of their lives. And Neville Brothers also putting out great stuff around that time. Talk about how that happens and what happened after Katrina and since your book has been published. I mean, did Katrina completely wipe this out, or is New Orleans still surviving and is the old music still alive?
New Orleans is very much still there. That's another question. But let's go back to Dr. John. Mack Rebennack, who remained highly creative right up until his final moments, and who produced all of his records are worthy of checking out. His take on Saints. Now, Saints was a song that really, I think, Louis Armstrong, was the one who popularized it and made it into the sort of New Orleans anthem. And you know, I sort of feel like, you know, if you hear a New Orleans band play when the Saints go marching in, that means they think you're a tourist. I sort of see it as an indirect dig at the audience. But there's a sign in Preservation Hall, you know, requests 5 cents, and Saints, you know, $1. But Dr. John says that this was an older song called When the Wicked Shall Cease to Roam in a minor key. And by playing it as a dirge and bringing in the power that is Mavis Staples, to hear the two of them together just gives me goosebumps. That was when I actually got to face to face talking with Mack, tell him how much I appreciated his bringing that song back into the sacred space again. And he thanked me for saying that because he knew exactly what I was talking about. In terms of your question about is it still going on in New Orleans? Well, New Orleans took a serious blow, and it's a permanent transformation of the city. Everything, you know, as you know, to take another example, the pandemic is a permanent transformation of our lives and the society we live in. Pretty early on in the pandemic, we realized it's not that things are just going to come back to normal. This is where we are, and we have to work forward from the position we're at. That's happened in New Orleans, in particular in New Orleans, where so many people, if they didn't have a destination when the city was completely forcibly evacuated, and people were given one-way tickets to cities, not to destinations, not of their choosing, all over the country in order to disperse the Black community of New Orleans as much as possible. A number of middle-class Black people were not able to get back to New Orleans, and they have they were a somewhat smaller, you know, I think as many as 100,000 people short for a while. I think over the years, though, people have been filtering back. New Orleans has a Black mayor again. I'm optimistic about New Orleans culture, even as I'm pessimistic about the future of the United States and of the biosphere and of New Orleans' physical existence. I'm confident that the culture of New Orleans is in good hands these days.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that, Ned. And I wish we had more time to hear you drop science about New Orleans. And thanks for the corrections on my too many mistakes. But my guest has been Ned Stublett. The book is The Year Before the Flood, A Story of New Orleans, which I cannot recommend highly enough. My wife doesn't pay any attention to my music books, but I'm making her read this one. It's such a powerful book for anybody, music fan or not music fan. It's American history, and it's brutal and heartbreaking and also beautiful. And this culture that you've helped chronicle has given us all so much. So thanks, Ned, and hope to have you back to talk about Cuba next time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And may I say one more thing?
Sure.
I lead music immersion travel. And we are having a Post Mambo New Orleans music seminar February 1st through the 6th, 2023. 5 days of intensive cultural activity in New Orleans. If you want to join us, write me postmambo@gmail.com.
I might take you up on it, Ned, and I encourage all of our listeners to do so. Thanks again, Ned Stublett.
Thank you, Nate. Bye.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Nate welcomes back Dan Charnas to discuss hip-hop genius J Dilla. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.